session number 24573, Reel 6.
Mr. Darcy, Reel 6. We're talking about this Atlantic convoy you did aboard the Vamsitar. Could you tell us a little? We've looked at sort of the routine. Could you tell us a bit more about the voyage and what you remember of
I don't remember a great deal about it, other than being on the bridge. That was where I seemed to spend nearly all my waking hours, either on the bridge or sitting down having a meal or sitting on the bench in the wardroom. I didn't have any shipboard duties or responsibilities, because I was purely an officer under training. I didn't have a division to look after. I didn't have to worry about confidential books or any of these other things that officers get given to them as part of their responsibilities. As an officer under training, I was just a lad there to see what went on, to learn what I could, and to keep my mouth shut, basically. So that was the trip across the Atlantic. We went into Newfoundland, into St. John's, Newfoundland, with our convoy, not having lost any of them, I'm delighted to say. More by luck than judgment, I have to say. We were just lucky that we didn't run into any enemy submarines. So it was summertime in Newfoundland, and I must say the weather was rather nice. And for some reason, Captain D, who was in charge of the base at Newfoundland, had organized a camp out in the forest somewhere. And several of us from the various ships in the escort group were sent out there for a week to have a sort of holiday in this camp in the forest, which was quite interesting. I'd never lived in a bell tent before. And we were, latrines were dug, and it was really all quite primitive, but very pleasant, apart from the mosquitoes. And we lived in the forest, and we went swimming in lakes and all that sort of thing, and we had a nice relaxing time. Anyway, at the end of all that, we came back to St. John's, and we were getting ready now. We refueled and revictualled and done everything else that had to be done. And we were getting ready to help escort an eastbound convoy now that was going back to the UK. So, again, this was simply the same procedure in reverse to what we'd had coming out, except that about 4 days out from Northern Ireland, one of the ships in the convoy broke down, a merchant ship, and she was a fairly big ship. I can't remember her name now, but anyway, her engine packed up completely, and she was wallowing around in the ocean, and it was decided that the rest of the convoy would proceed without this ship, and that we, the Vansittart, would be left behind to look after it. And for a day or so, or more, we sort of steamed around it in a big circle, what you might call a sort of protective circle around this ship, while they tried to get their engine going again. But for whatever reason, they weren't able to do this. So it was decided that we would take this thing in tow, which was quite an interesting exercise, especially for me, who'd never had anything like that to do before in my life. And we did. We took it in tow. The first tow broke, and it was decided that it was just too tight. It was hanging too. It was stretched too tightly.
What was the procedure? Can you remember how they actually went about it?
Well, I can remember how it was done after a while. When it was decided that what we should do to actually get the tow going, the tow rope was passed to the from our stern to the bow of this vessel, and it was an enormous great grass, what they call a grass line, big rope, probably about 8 inches in circumference, an enormous rope. And what they did, they took this rope up through the hawse pipe of the anchor, and they fastened it to the shackle holding the anchor cable onto the anchor itself, and then they paid out the anchor cable. The result of this was that you had an enormously heavy tow line, and even when we took up the strain, when they paid out probably, I don't know, 100 feet or more of cable with the anchor hanging down at the front end of it, and then our rope fastened onto that, and then we took the strain and started towing very slowly. And this worked very well because the tow line was so heavy that it never came up tight. It was too heavy to come tight. So we were able to tow this thing in this strange manner at about 3 knots, possibly 4. And when I was officer of the watch, when I was doing my stint as duty junior officer of the watch, instead of being on the bridge as usual, I had to sit right down on the quarter deck alongside the tow and watch it carefully, ready to shout bloody murder if anything nasty appeared to be happening to it. And that's where I spent the rest of that trip when I was on watch, sitting down on the quarter deck looking at the tow line and generally watching the ship that we were towing and seeing that things were going along as they should. And it was rather interesting because I'd forgotten all about this until many years later, back in, I think in 1947 or 48 sometime, I got a letter from the Admiralty Prize Court or something like that, asking me if I could tell them where I was on a certain date. And I narrowed it down to being on board Van Sittert. And I thought this, the only thing this can be was to do with towing this ship. And sure enough, it turned out that that's exactly what it was, and I got some money. Some salvage money, which was completely out of the blue. I can't remember how much it was now. It was about something under £100, but it was very nice in 1947, I can assure you. That's just something that happened many years later.
And which port did you tow her into?
We towed her back to the northwest corner of Ireland, and at that point, an ocean-going tug came out, presumably from Derry. I imagine it must have been come from Derry, or possibly had come round from Belfast, I don't know, and took over the tow and towed her away. We never saw her again, and we went back into Londonderry, up the Foyle, and into Londonderry itself.
And that's where you left the ship. Yes. Will this still be August?
This is sometime in August, I would say. So that was the end of my trip. I bade farewell to the Van Sittert, and that was the end of it as far as I was concerned. But I had had a very interesting time. I'd learned a lot. I'd experienced quite a lot, seen a great deal, and I'm quite sure I'd learned a great deal, you know. So that was it, and I was sent home again. And off I went. Back to Belfast, and then across the water, and then down the train lines down to Euston. It was a dreadful journey in those times. Anyway, I went home, and I was home probably for a week, or maybe a little bit more, and then I finally got my proper appointment from Admiralty. And my appointment was that I was to join a ship that was being built in the United States, and her name was Gore, and that my instructions were to proceed back up to Glasgow and there to join the Queen Mary for transport to New York. So I had a nice week's leave in London at home, and then that was it. I set off, and I went up to Scotland again, and I joined the Queen Mary at, I suppose, is it Dunoon? I can't remember if they called it Dunoon. Anyway, it's just by Glasgow somewhere. She was out in the Clyde, and I joined her. Now the Queen Mary at that time was being used as a troop ship. She was bringing enormous numbers of American servicemen over from America, airmen and soldiers and all sorts, I believe she sometimes carried as many as 15,000 or 16,000 troops on these journeys from the United States. But going to the United States, she was, by comparison, empty. There were several hundred naval personnel of one sort and another on board the ship. But really, she was, it was like rattling around like a pea in a drum. The cabins had all been altered in the sense that double cabins had about 12 bunks in them, and there were beds everywhere. But of course, there was nobody really, apart from a few of us, requiring all this. So we had a very interesting journey across to America. We actually got there in the first week of September. So we must have left Scotland, I suppose, right at the end of August, because it probably took us about 6 days or something, six or seven days to get there. And in fact, it could be tied down, if you were to look up the date when Italy surrendered, we were halfway across the Atlantic at that time, and that was the beginning of September 1943. Because I can remember we got the news about the surrender of Italy. Anyway, we went across to the States on the Queen Mary and came into New York Harbour. The journey across was interesting, but nothing of note happened. The Queen Mary was what was known as an IRMS, that is to say, an independently routed merchant ship. She was capable of such speeds that submarines, unless they were very, very lucky and happened to be right in her path, would never have a chance of catching her. So she was allowed to plough the ocean without any escort at all. So anyhow, there we were. We arrived at New York, and there were quite a gang of people. I'd never met any of them before. They were just chaps who'd been on the ship with me. And the officers went to a hotel in New York called the Barbizon Plaza. All the British naval officers went to the Barbizon Plaza, and we were allocated rooms there. We had a very nice, a very comfortable hotel. I believe it's still there. A very comfortable hotel, and we all had rooms to ourselves, and there was something called the White Ensign Club down below on the ground floor, which was a big room which had been allocated to the Royal Navy, and we used to meet there and get our instructions as to what we were to do and not to do and all the rest of it. And I remember we were given a sort of welcoming speech by a bloke, a naval officer, I think he was a commander, who was based in New York. The New York base, by the way, was called HMS Saker, S-A-K-E-R. And this guy, this commander, was part of the Saker organization, and he gave us a welcoming speech telling us sort of what to do and what not to do and how to behave in America and how to regard Americans as not being Englishmen.
Do you remember much of what he said?
Not a great deal. The one thing that always tickled me was he said that whatever you do, he said, never talk politics to an American. Never talk American politics to an American. He said, you will know absolutely nothing about it. You can take my word for it, he probably won't know much more than you will, but he'll have very, very strong opinions about it. So don't discuss politics. I always remember that. Quite, it used to make me laugh. Anyway.
Much hospitality from the Americans.
Oh, yes.
Can you talk about that a bit? Because apparently yes. They arranged sort of tickets to sporting events.
Oh, well, yes.
That's what you remember.
Yes, I was in New York. The weather was very nice, by the way. It was lovely hot weather, the early part of September. It was beautifully hot weather. In fact, almost too hot. And we had the days to ourselves, because until we were allocated to a place to go, there was nothing to do except amuse ourselves, which was very easy to do in New York. People wanted to entertain you all the time. You could, any night, any evening, you could find telephone numbers of people who would say, please ring us up and we'll come and pick you up and take you out for the evening and take you to our homes and all the rest of it. They were very, very, very hospitable. And I got friendly with a couple of other chaps who were staying at the hotel as well. And we used to sort of wander around as a little threesome. And in fact, we did, on a couple of occasions that week that I was there, we took up invitations that people... We went as a little group of three. And we had a couple of very, very nice evenings in people's homes, giving us very good meals and carting us around in their cars and all the rest of it.
Well, were they doing this business of free tickets to...
I never got any free tickets. I suppose there may have been some available, but I never availed myself of it. I was rather interested in the jazz clubs, to be perfectly honest. I always was very keen on good, solid jazz. And I found I found one or two quite nice places where you could go and listen to good jazz. I remember one in particular, a place called Kelly's Stable, which I've heard mentioned on the television in more recent years as being one of the homes of some of the really good jazz musicians of the day. And I used to go there sometimes in the evening and just listen to jazz and have a few drinks. We went out with some American people who were very kind to us. And apart from that, in the daytime, we used to wander around and up and down Broadway and all these places, looking at Central Park and all the rest of it. It was very interesting to all of us. And, in fact, on one occasion, we were on Broadway itself. And there was a police car, an American police car, parked at the side of the road. And we went up looking at it because we'd never seen these except in the movies. And it was all sirens and bells and things. And the policeman came up and said, "What, do you guys want something, you see?" So we just said, no, we're just looking, very interested to see your car, but whenever we see them, they're always tearing up and down the street, making a terrific noise with bells and sirens. He said, "Well, you just wait right there," he said, and he got in the car with his mate, and he set off up Broadway, bells and sirens going, turned round about several blocks up and came tearing back down again and said, "What do you think of that?" That was the American way of life. It was very good. I liked all that sort of thing. Anyway, after about a week or so, I was then given my instructions, and I was to go to a place called Asbury Park. Asbury Park is south of New York, just a little way in the state of New Jersey, and it's a seaside resort on the Atlantic coast. And the Royal Navy had taken over two hotels in Asbury Park. One of them was called the Monterey, and the other one was called something else, which I can't remember. But these two hotels were facing each other across a street, and the Navy had put a fence right the way round both hotels, so the whole thing was enclosed within a perimeter fence, and the street in between the two hotels was used as a sort of parade ground and marching space. And we went down there. I went down, and two or three of the other chaps who were there in New York went down as well. We went down to Asbury Park by train, as far as I remember. And we stayed there, I should think, for about 3 weeks. And
so you were in the Monterey, were you?
In the Monterey and the something else.
You don't remember which one you were in?
No, I was in the Monterey. Yeah. That's, I think, why I remember the name better. Anyway, and we were there, I should think, for about 3 weeks. And basically what we did all the time was practice celestial navigation, that is to say, practice using sextants. And we used to go down onto, there was a sort of you'd almost call it a pier, a big jetty, I suppose, there on the front. And we used to go down there in the morning with our sextants, and we would shoot the sun sort of mid-morning, and then we'd shoot it again around about midday, while you could still get a horizon. And then we had to work out where we were. And the plan always, of course, was to try and work out that you were where you actually were, on the end of the pier at Asbury Park. but it helped a great deal. This was the handling of the sextant and the getting the accurate reading of the sextant, which I talked about before, I think. Anyway,
anything else you were doing, or was it just that?
That was it. That was the studying. That was the work that we did. There was nothing else for us to do down there.
Was there much recreation?
Again, you had all the recreation you wanted. I met some very nice people there. I met a couple of families who invited me home and fed me and all the rest of it. One guy, I can remember his name, what was he called? Mortimer Klinkerstein. There you are, that's a lovely name. He was in the Inland Revenue Service, the American Inland Revenue Service. And another guy, whose name I can't remember, who manufactured pipes, smoker's pipes. And he gave me one, because I used to smoke a pipe in those days. And they were very nice families, nice people. And they were very pleased to have English blokes about and talk to them and so on. So anyway, that was it. That was Asbury Park, and that was for about 2 or 3 weeks. So we're probably up now to the end of September, even the very beginning of October, I should think. So then the next thing was, I got instructions to proceed to Boston and pick up my ship, which was being prepared. So I went back to New York, spent a night or possibly two nights again at the Barbizon Plaza, and then I was given my railway tickets, and I went to Boston on a magnificent train called the Boston Flyer. I remember the name. I sat in a Pullman car, and it was quite extraordinary, not anything like trains I'd been on in England, and certainly not like the wartime trains in England. Anyway, up to Boston we went, or I went, on my own I was this time. And I found my way down to the Charlestown Navy Yard, where I was told to report. And I went down there, and sure enough, Gore was just about being finished off in the dry dock. She had been built, actually, there in the dock at the Charlestown Navy Yard. And I met then the other blokes who were going to be my colleagues and friends for the next nearly 2 years.
Now, what were your first impressions of? Can you run through?
Yes. It was very difficult. When I first saw Gore, she wasn't even in the water. She was still in the dry dock. But I liked the look of her. She had a nice, squat, active, comfortable look about her. I liked the look of the line of the ship. I was amazed at the lack of any portholes along her side. This is very unusual. I mean, pretty well all British ships had portholes. This thing didn't. There was nothing. It was solid. And, of course, I was very interested in the fact that she was welded. She was a welded ship, which I'd never seen before.
Did you have any preconceptions about that? Because some Royal Navy, especially experienced people, didn't like it.
I was just going to say, I didn't have enough experience and sense to be worried. Do you see what I mean? I didn't know enough about it to regard it as being a matter of concern. Had more experience, I might have been more worried. But as it was, it looked fine to me.
Now, we're just looking at a picture of the Gore,
K-481. Yeah.
Can you run through her, what you thought of her, you know?
Well, the guns looked very old-fashioned, I thought. I wasn't an expert on guns, but I had seen better guns on British ships. And these things did look rather antiquated. They turned out to be 3-inch quick-firing guns, and they were adequate for their requirement, as it turned out. the rest of it looked very nice. She looked comfortable and clean and well designed. And then when I went aboard, I discovered all these other new things that one didn't find in British ships.
Such as?
For example, when you went down into the forward mess deck, you felt you were in a submarine because there were no windows. That was the first thing. Then you realised that the sailors were all going to be sleeping in beds instead of hammocks. This was an unheard of thing in a ship of this type in the Royal Navy. There were triple bunks, three one above the other. Pardon me. And they all had their own bunks, which had never been heard of. There were ice water fountains in the mess decks. Never heard of that. There were quite well-designed showering facilities, much better than, generally speaking, the facilities for the men on board the ship were a great deal better than they were on comparable British ships. And the as it turned out later, she was a very dry ship. She didn't ship a lot of water into the mess decks, which was very nice. The officers' quarters, instead of being right aft, as they were in most British ships, were in the bridge structure, in this structure. The wardroom and the officers' cabins were on this upper deck level here, where my fingernail is. I'm sorry.
Underneath the bridge, yeah.
Underneath the bridge, there was the wardroom. And then there was one cabin led immediately off the wardroom, and then there was a passageway, and there were about four or five cabins up this passageway, and then at the top of it there were showering and toilet facilities again for the officers.
What were the cabins like? The officers' cabins.
Well, the cabins were fairly small but very well equipped. The cabins were fitted with very comfortable metal bunks with spring interior mattresses in them. And every cabin, every officer had his own desk with his own safe in it. What do they call these safes with a lock?
Just a lockable.
No, a thingamajig, a numbered lock, you know. Combination lock, that's right. Every desk had one of these combination lock safes in it. There was plenty of cupboard space and drawer space and enough hanging space. And every cabin also had a very nice wash basin with hot and cold running water, which was extremely, very, very nice indeed, very comfortable. And these cabins, being on the upper deck, had portholes out to the open air. So in the daytime, you could have daylight coming into your cabin, which was very, very, very nice indeed.